This is St. Louis Public Radio. Support comes from Parrot Corporation. With a commitment to serving the St. Louis community through local partnerships and charitable support, guided by Parrot's core values. More at parrot.com/culture.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Hi, everybody. This is Jason Rosenbaum, a politics correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. Todd Richardson would never be accused of having a tranquil time during his nearly 15-year tenure in Missouri state government. Richardson became House Speaker abruptly in 2015 after a scandal brought down his predecessor. And his last House session in 2018 coincided with the demise of Eric Greitens' governorship, placing the Poplar Bluff Republican in the spotlight amid high-profile impeachment deliberations. Richardson's post-elected life hasn't gotten any less eventful. He's the director of Missouri's Medicaid program, a massive enterprise that helps low-income disabled and elderly Missourians pay for critical healthcare services. Since taking on that role in 2018, Richardson dealt with upgrading antiquated technology, a once-in-a-generation pandemic, and the advent of a historic Medicaid expansion to the working poor. And now, thanks to Congress and President Donald Trump, Richardson could oversee new work requirements and the potential depreciation of medical provider taxes that Missouri used for decades to pay for Medicaid. Last week, I went to Jefferson City to talk with Richardson about how Missouri's Medicaid program works and some of the longer-term challenges and opportunities for the state's healthcare system. I started off by asking a relatively straightforward question. What is Missouri's Medicaid program, which is known here as MoHealthNet, and how many Missourians depend on it for healthcare?
Missouri HealthNet is Missouri's Medicaid program. Been a lot of discussion about Medicaid in the news of late, but Medicaid is a program that's been around since 1965 and in general provides coverage for those Missourians who are most in need, is the way we would describe it. So we have about 1.3 million Missourians on the program today. That's comprised in our large eligibility groups of our age, blind, and disabled population, kids, a ton of kids on the program. And then also through the voter-approved Medicaid expansion, we now have about 300,000 adults on the program.
So you just described Medicaid in shorthand, because when I describe it, I say it's a healthcare program for low-income, disabled, and elderly people. And I want to dig a little bit deeper on that descriptor. Why would older adults, for instance, need Medicaid when they have access to Medicare?
Yeah, we have a tremendous number of individuals who are what we would call dual eligible. So they're eligible for Medicare and Medicaid as a result of their income. Medicaid has become one of the largest, it is the largest provider of long-term care. So a lot of our nursing home care in the United States, and this is true in Missouri, is paid for through Medicaid.
Do you know how many people would be in that older adults pool compared to the others?
We have about 350,000 Missourians who are in the program in that age, blind, and disabled category. So that'd be a combination. I don't have the breakout between that, but we have about 350,000 in that group.
Now, can you describe how Medicaid is available for people who are disabled?
Yeah, it's available in Missouri based on a disability determination. So our colleagues at the Family Support Division here at Social Services employ a medical review team. So if somebody applies by virtue of that disability, that medical review team looks at the individual's circumstances and makes a determination of whether they're disabled. Very similar, I believe, identical criteria that Social Security uses for the purpose of their disability determination.
One of the things I've read throughout the years is that there's often tension between disabled Missourians who need access to Medicaid but can't earn as much money as they could potentially make since they'd lose access to the program. How does somebody navigate that, especially if they want to earn enough money to live independently?
Yeah, I think it's an area of the program that we need to look at, Jason. We certainly don't want, and I think this is true for a larger suite of our social services programs. We certainly don't want there to be a disincentive or something that prevents somebody who wants to earn more. I was talking with members of the General Assembly, a member of the General Assembly, about this yesterday. So I do think it's an area that we need to look at and where our income thresholds are and how we allow a little flexibility for that person who is on disability but has the ability to earn an income to keep the services that they very much need for Medicaid.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but hasn't there been some sort of legislation that aims to like do a step down as opposed to a cliff? Has that just not been fully implemented yet?
We have a method in Medicaid today that we call spend down, which is a somewhat complicated process, but it allows somebody to spend down their income on qualifying medical expenses and retain access to care. So we do have some of that ability today, but I know there are advocates and individuals on the program who would like to see more done there, and I think we would be open to those conversations.
I want to talk about kids, though, because I would think that like one of the larger groups is through the Children's Health Insurance Program. Can you tell me how that dovetails with Medicaid in general, and maybe how it's different from some of those other categories?
It operates in our state very similar. It's a category of eligibility that individuals are entitled to kind of the same suite of benefits that the rest of the program is entitled to. We have kids on the program not just through CHIP, but also through what we would call straight or regular Medicaid. But it's a full suite of insurance benefits, just like you or I would think about our health insurance plans.
My understanding, though, is the eligibility is much higher than an adult. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we cover children up to 300% of the federal poverty level, which is a fairly high level. Not every state's at that level. But what comes with that is a requirement that there's a premium once you hit certain eligibility categories, or certain income thresholds. So it allows us to open up Medicaid coverage for those kids that need it, but also to do so in a fair way by assessing that premium.
And does the premium go up depending on where you are in the income scale? So
it
let's
does.
Say you're at 299% of the federal poverty level, your premium will be higher than if you're at 167,
correct,
basically. We've talked about who's eligible. I want to talk about like what would happen and what you can get if you're actually on Medicaid. So let's just say I qualify for Medicaid under any of these categories and I want to get healthcare services. How would Medicaid work in order for me to get access to that?
Yeah, Medicaid operates very similar and almost identically from a patient perspective to our private insurance plans. So you go to the doctor. In the case of our managed care participants, they're going to have an insurance card from one of our three managed care plans, and they're going to go to a doctor, and that insurance is going to pay for the services. So we cover all of the things that you would think of as traditional healthcare services. We cover hospital care, doctor's office visits, pharmacy programs, and then including some long-term care benefits as well that aren't always covered in traditional health insurance plans.
This doesn't go to the patient. Like,
right,
it goes to the doctor or the healthcare provider. When I say this, I mean that they don't, a person doesn't just get a lump sum money,
right,
and then they spend it on healthcare. Can you explain that process, which may seem obvious, but
right,
I think is important to point out here?
Yeah, outside of a very, very small percentage of our budget, less than 2%, which goes to administration, the entirety of the money that gets appropriated to MoHealthNet goes to pay providers. And so when a doctor in Missouri sees a Missouri Medicaid participant, they're going to submit a bill for that, and we're going to pay that bill. So all those dollars associated with the program are going not to the participants, but going to the medical providers, whether that be a doctor, a hospital, a pharmacy, for the services that they're providing.
And so when people talk kind of offhandedly about waste, fraud, and abuse, that's not Medicaid recipients who are stealing money. That would probably be providers who are like inflating costs or making up healthcare services, and I'm talking about in a hypothetical sense.
Yeah, we have entities that focus on reducing both. We think it is incredibly important that we are laser focused on rooting out all of the fraud, waste, and abuse we can in the program, because it risks the sustainability of the program for those who are truly eligible. So we do have entities that work to make sure that the individuals who are on the program are in fact eligible. But we also have groups that work to make sure that providers are following the rules of the program as well.
You have been the director of this program when, as you mentioned, Missouri expanded Medicaid under the auspices of the Affordable Care Act. That means that people who are making up to 138% of the federal poverty level can now qualify for Medicaid. It's been about, what, 4 years Yeah. since it's happened? How has that gone so far?
I think the implementation and the start of the program has gone incredibly smooth from the state's perspective. It is not an easy task to take a program like this and open it up to now 300,000 additional participants. It was almost a 30% expansion of the enrollment in our program, but I think it's gone very well. Obviously, that happened at the same time the state was operating under the federal public health emergency and continuous eligibility requirements as a result of COVID. So we have had a lot of flux in terms of, and a lot of change in terms of where our enrollment overall in the program is. But I think overall, Medicaid expansion has gone fairly well in Missouri, certainly from a participant and a provider perspective. I think there are the longer term, you know, strategic or sort of macro challenges with what it means for the state's budget and how we ensure that that benefit and the program overall are sustainable over time. And that's been a lot of what we've been working on in terms of the budgetary picture relating to expansion.
And you kind of read my mind, because that was my next question. I've covered the question about whether to expand Medicaid for almost two decades now. And the biggest argument, especially from the Republican side against that, was the long-term cost. But Missouri ended up getting, I believe, $1 or $2 billion from the federal government from the American Rescue Plan. Has that helped defray whatever the state would have had to pay for its share of Medicaid expansion, at least in the short term?
Yes. The short answer to that is it has. And it's pushed off the need to use general revenue to fund the expansion portion. But once those funds are exhausted, it's going to be a cost. And so, you know, we're obviously going to work with our partners in the General Assembly to make sure that it doesn't have the kind of negative impact on the budget that some people fear.
Do you know how much longer that and it's $2 billion, correct?
I think overall. I mean, yeah. there's a couple of sources of money there, but overall, that's about right.
Do you know how much longer that's going to last as a way of supplanting general revenue before it runs out?
I think you can expect that in fiscal year 27, we just started fiscal year 26, but in fiscal year 27, we'll start to have that need.
Is there any, I mean, this is a difficult question because we just don't know what the need is going to be in a year, but do you have any estimates about how much general revenue the state is going to have to put up for the Medicaid expansion program at this point?
I don't have it for fiscal year 27. In broad terms, and in very general terms, you know, we're spending about $3.5 billion on the expansion program. Missouri's share of that is 10%, so $350 million in ballpark numbers.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you were watching very carefully the One Big Beautiful Bill's deliberation, where they were thinking of dropping that by 2031. Whether you were still Medicaid director by then,
right,
who knows? But like, given that that is in the Constitution and the state can't just turn away enrollees, can you talk about how fiscally damaging that could have been without like major changes to the Constitution?
Yeah, changes in the match rate for the Medicaid expansion population would have been very difficult for Missouri to deal with. As you mentioned, our Medicaid expansion benefits in the Constitution specifies what level of benefits are included with the expansion population. So it would have been very difficult for the state to weather a change that would have been a significant increase or decrease in the level of federal support for the program.
One of the issues that I often read about when we talk about Medicaid is difficulties of people applying and getting accepted into the program. An issue in particular that some media outlets honed in on is a lag time between somebody applies and when they're accepted into the Medicaid program. I'm not sure if that is your lane or whether that's another part of DSS, but it is part of Medicaid.
For sure.
I'm interested to hear how that's going, given that that has been probably a perennial issue that you've had to deal with since you became director.
Yeah, I think our colleagues at Family Support Division have made tremendous progress in improving the processing times, improving the performance of the call center, particularly over the last several months. I think it's important to note, you know, if you went back to immediately pre-COVID, we had just over about 890,000 Missourians on Medicaid. Today, I mentioned we've got 1.3 million. So it's a significant increase in the amount of work that Family Support Division has to keep up, and there hasn't been the corresponding level of increase in staffing. So what we're focused on is trying to improve how efficient we are at using the resources that we have. And that means better use of technology, better use of data, trying to automate as many of the applications where it we can do it without in what we would call a no-touch format, meaning that we can verify the information electronically and approve that so that we don't have to spend as much staff time approving and re-verifying those applications. So I think progress is being made there, but I think if you talk to Director Bax, who's been laser focused on this issue, or Director Adams at Family Support Division, they would tell you that we've still got more work to do.
When I talk about kind of technology and the way like Missouri's Medicaid system operates from a functional level, I'm sure we could get really into the weeds with like computer systems and computer programs that I have no way of really asking an intelligent question about. But like, let's just say when you started here in 2018, how outdated would you say the technology was in terms of managing the program compared to now?
I've heard others describe it as the best technology money could buy in 1978.
1978?
We do have some systems that are that old. But there has been I think the systems were you know, they did what they were designed to do very well. And some of them continue to do what they were designed to do very well. But they certainly presented limitations for our staff and for our ability to manage the program. There has been a dramatic improvement in our systems. Still more work to do there, but our ability to access and use Medicaid data today, and particularly to use it to drive informed data-driven policy decisions, is miles better than it would have been back in 2018.
You know, there's been a lot of discussions about artificial intelligence and how it could make people's lives better. I mean, there's also doomsday scenarios that artificial intelligence could eventually kill everybody because it becomes sentient and decides to start a nuclear war. Let's not talk about that scenario. Okay. Let's talk about the good scenarios. Has anybody in your department explored whether AI could help in terms of the application process? Or is this kind of treacherous since there could be some eligibility determinations that may require a human being and not an imaginary human being to review the application?
Yeah, I think the state is obviously wants to make good use of the technological tools that are available, and AI will be a part of that. We're going to make sure that we're entering into that in a responsible way. But to the extent that we think it can improve the productivity, I know the department is exploring it.
We're talking with Todd Richardson, the director of Missouri's Mo HealthNet program, another name for Missouri's Medicaid program. So this conversation about technology dovetails nicely into the One Big Beautiful Bill discussion, which I'm sure you know is going to affect Medicaid quite a bit. From a technological standpoint, how prepared is Missouri to make sure that Medicaid enrollees can comply with whatever work requirements end up being put in place?
Yeah, work requirements is obviously something that's going to be brand new to the program. I think we're excited about the opportunity to be able to implement work requirements. It's been an idea that, you know, the state has had around for a while. So the ability to do it is a welcome opportunity for us. You know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, we focus a lot on the sustainability of the program, and I think ensuring that that our Medicaid expansion population is meeting those work requirements is obviously going to be an important part of that sustainability picture. But we also want to make sure that that's done in the least difficult way for the participants. the ability to do the verifications that someone would need to have electronically now has improved dramatically from where it would be 10 years ago. So, I think you're aware the state has a partnership now with a company called SteadyIQ, which helps do income verification. We also have other partners like at Equifax that provide data in that lane as well. So I think what will be important is for the state to make sure that we're making good use of those tools, make sure, number one, we're getting the verifications done correctly and accurately, but also to do so in the way that's the most efficient for both the state and for the participants.
Yeah, there's been obviously a lot of discussion about the work requirements and how they could potentially be crafted in such an onerous way that even people who qualify for Medicaid end up losing their coverage. My counterpoint to that is if you set up a system where it's pretty easy to access a portal or a website where you just upload documents and it takes you 10 minutes twice a year, then I could see people being able to comply with that relatively easily, especially if there is an education campaign to let people know what the requirements are. That's more of an observation than a question, but is that something that your department is going to strive to do whenever these work requirements go into effect?
Absolutely. Our goal is to make sure that people who are eligible and entitled to be on the program have the easiest path to get access to those benefits, while at the same time ensuring that those who are not eligible for the program are not on the program. So with the tools that we have today, I think what participants will see is a process that really is smooth, because even beyond a portal where people can upload documents, there's a lot of this verification that can be done without the participant having to do anything at all. And so I think for a lot of those individuals, our hope is that we can do that verification in such a way that it's no touch from the state or the participant.
What, can you kind of elaborate on that? I know that, again, the work requirements are still kind of in flux, but how would somebody be able to comply with them without doing anything?
Well, if they're working and we can verify that they're working through income data, then that's a verification right there. Now, there are other exceptions to the work requirements that probably will require a participant to send some documentation or to involve a human. But I think there's a lot of that income verification that can be done electronically.
Yeah, and I think that's been where a lot of the criticism of this has come in from, I guess, the left end of the political spectrum, especially if you're on the Medicaid expansion side of Medicaid, you are working. I mean, otherwise, like, I don't know how you're getting $15,000 a year unless it's falling out of the sky. So I think the argument against this, and this is obviously not in your control because you're no longer a legislator and you're not a member of Congress, but like, this is seen as just sort of a paperwork trap that may kick eligible people off of Medicaid. You've probably heard these arguments all before. As an administrator, what is the argument for work requirements that would make this Medicaid system stronger and better in your view?
I think it's about it being sustainable for the long term. And I think that's at the core of why work requirements were included in the reconciliation package. But we want the program to be available for those who need it. Work requirements is a way to ensure that the population on the program is sustainable for the long term.
Do you know what the timeline is that you have to have the work requirements in place?
We've got a number of different timelines because work requirements isn't the only eligibility requirement that's in the one big beautiful bill. I believe the work requirements provision kicks in at the start of 2027.
I think that there was an executive order during the Biden administration that cut off the waiting period for the CHIPS program. And I think the One Big Beautiful Bill got rid of that and allows states to wait 90 days, up to 90 days. How is that going to affect like kids being able to get into the program? That hasn't been talked about as much. But when I read that in the One Big Beautiful Bill, I was like, that could be impactful to people that may need access to that program sooner than 90 days.
Yeah, we're still working through what the impacts are going to be on some of those things, Jason. There are changes to what we call the eligibility rule, which was was formalized late in the Biden administration. So we're going to evaluate what the impacts of those are, and we also know that there are several provisions of those of the bill that require more guidance from our federal partners at CMS. So more to come on that.
Now, I think that the provision of the One Big Beautiful Bill that had, I think, the most controversy even among Republicans, because let me just kind of peel back the political curtain here. I would say that the work requirements were pretty much had unanimous Republican support in Congress. But the medical provider tax restrictions were really controversial among Republicans. It's the reason why Tom Tillis didn't vote for it. Yep. Josh Hawley had raised alarm about it, and he's trying to actually repeal it. Explain what Missouri's medical provider tax is, who it covers, and how this bill would affect the medical provider tax down the road.
Provider tax is a structure that's been in place in Missouri since the early 90s, mid-90s, and it's a way that we help finance our Medicaid program. So in short, it's a tax that's levied on we levy it on hospitals, nursing homes, ambulance districts, and pharmacies to different degrees and different levels, but most of the focus on the federal bill was about the hospital portion of that tax. The state levies a tax on hospitals based on a percentage of their total revenue. We take those tax dollars into the state, and we use those to finance a portion of our Medicaid program. So that's how the program operates. It's been in place for a long time.
Do you know what the tax is right now? The Missouri Hospital Association said it was 4.2%. I read another article that said it was 5% on hospitals. Like, I want to make sure I know what the percent is right now.
But both answers are correct. Our hospital tax rate varies based on the way the General Assembly appropriates our budget and based on what the need in the program is. For fiscal year 25, our tax rate was 4.2%. And for fiscal year 26, which we just started, it will be 5%.
Okay. So,
both answers are right. We are currently less reliant on the provider tax than we have been in the last 20 years, which has been a lot of work. It's been a focus of the department. It's been a focus of the General Assembly. So while we're not unconcerned about the potential for that cap to go down, because what's in the bill is that cap would go down from a current level of 6% today to 3.5%. While we're not unconcerned about that change, we're in a much better position to deal with that than we would have been if we still had our tax rate pegged out at the 6% cap, which is where we were just a few years ago.
Now, I've heard differing opinions about this point, which is kind of a technical point, but could be important. Is the 5% cap now frozen until 2028, or could it go up to 6% like right before it goes down?
No, it's now frozen at where it is in time. So the tax the amount that the tax generates could go up, but the 5% is now where we are until that cap goes down.
From reading the bill, I think in 2028, that's when it drops to 5.5%, which wouldn't affect Missouri because we're at 5. It would start affecting Missouri probably like what, around
2031, somewhere in that neighborhood. Yeah. It's also a little bit speculative, right? Because as I mentioned, it's the tax is based on a percentage. And so when that the demand floats up and down, whether that has an impact in 2030 is a little hard to estimate as we're sitting here in 2026.
Yeah, and also if it's at 5% for the next 4 years, and let's just say it goes fully into effect and 5% is more than what's needed, couldn't you like use the excess money from that to cushion the blow to that? Or would going down to 3.5% be so costly to the state that that's just not going to be that helpful?
I don't know that we don't really like to sort of build up big reserves in those tax collections. We usually try to make sure that the tax rate is, pretty close to what the need on the program is. So I don't know that that's really a viable strategy to try to mitigate that.
That is a very in the weeds question. But one question that's not in the weeds is, as kind of a compromise here, there was this $50 billion rural hospital fund. Senator Hawley says Missouri is going to get about $1 billion worth of that. Do you have any sense of like how the state can use that money, or hospitals just, are these just going to go directly to hospitals, or would it go through the Medicaid program?
The state is must submit a plan to CMS by December 31st of this year for how it would allocate those dollars. So we're actively working along with others in state government on what that plan should look like. And obviously that's something that ultimately will be Governor Kehoe's decision to make, but we're certainly going to be involved in framing up some of the options for how those dollars would be allocated. We're very excited about that, that fund and the ability to be able to provide some direct support for rural hospitals. It's something that's been a focus of Missouri Health Net for the last 6 years, and this gives us some additional resources to focus on it.
Again, this is speculative because we don't know if the medical provider tax restrictions will ever go into effect. Like, if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, like, it could be repealed. Like, right. That's kind of why talking about this with certainty is kind of a fool's errand. But let's just say they do go fully into effect. There's a lot of fear that that could really hurt rural hospitals down the line, because the state will have to come up with the money to fill the hole in the Medicaid program, and it may be shifting from education or maybe paying providers less. Does that concern you about the impact of this if it goes into effect?
I think there's a lot of time for us to figure out how to manage that if it goes into effect. I think people, I certainly understand where the concern comes from. And I think there are very good reasons to be concerned about what the future of healthcare looks like in the rural parts of our state, which is why I think you see so many policymakers trying to focus on it. I think it's why you see Missouri Health Net focused on it, and I think it's why you see our federal partners focused on it. We are sliding down a path, and this is not a Missouri-specific statement. We are sliding down a path where we have two types of health systems, big hospital-based systems, large ones and extinct ones. And I think that's a problem that policymakers and administrators of Medicaid programs are going to have to wrestle with, which is, how do we ensure that rural Missourians continue to have access to health care? Maybe it doesn't look exactly like it did in the 1970s, but those communities still need health care and they still need access to the care. And that's a growing problem. It's not necessarily driven entirely by changes in Medicaid policy or federal spending. It's more a systemic challenge that I think healthcare is facing, but it's something that we've got to figure out a solution to.
Yeah, and I want to touch on that for a minute, because Poplar Bluff still has a hospital, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so one of my friends used to live in Donovan, Missouri, which used to have a hospital and no longer does. And what she told me is, after like access to healthcare there shut down, people moved to Poplar Bluff, and that kind of hollowed out a community like Donovan, which has a long and storied history. And this has probably been replicated in many other smaller rural cities across the state. How you solve that problem, though, is I don't know how you solve that problem, because if the demand isn't there for hospitals to be financially viable, either they're going to have to be like heavily, heavily, heavily subsidized by the government, or you're going to just have smaller healthcare systems there that are not hospitals. Again, more of an observation than a question, but I think that this is more than just about access to healthcare. This is about the economic vitality of rural Missouri.
Yeah, I mean, I actually referenced the Donovan example quite often. I also reference one from Kennett, which is, you know, kind of, but both in my neck of the woods, so to speak. Donovan used to have a 50-bed full-service hospital. And the reality is the market's not going to support a 50-bed full-service hospital in a community like Donovan. The challenge is that community still needs access to healthcare. And the observation that you make is one we have seen in other places, which is if the hospital closes, generally it means a degradation of the rest of the healthcare infrastructure that was around it. So I think the challenge going forward is, how do we find a model that's not so much focused on trying to maintain what we had, but how do we develop a model that's focused on trying to ensure that the healthcare that the community needs is present there? And that probably means something that looks different than that 50-bed full-service hospital in a community the size of Donovan.
Could be telemedicine. But again, you need access to broadband for that to occur.
Yeah, I mean, telemedicine certainly plays a role in that. But I think, you know, you've seen the advent of what's now called the rural emergency hospital designation, which provides an opportunity for, you know, a very small emergency department kind of focused hospital where you could build urgent care around it. You know, our FQHCs and Donovan's an example of this, continue to fill a really important role in communities like that, providing the backbone of some healthcare infrastructure there now. So I don't know that anybody's got the answer completely figured out, but I do think there are some things and some things that we're trying to do at Medicaid to improve the sustainability of healthcare in those areas.
In preparation for this interview, I realized you've been on this job for almost, what, 7, 8 years
now?
Yeah,
since the fall of 2018.
What has this job been like for you? Like, it started off after a very tumultuous time in your political life, and then you had COVID, and then you had Medicaid expansion, and now you have this. It just seems like everywhere you turn, you're presented with one difficult challenge after another. Like, do you ever just want to, like, run into a cave and hide or something like that?
I like difficult challenges, Jason. And one of the things that made me really interested in this job was I like trying to solve big, complex public policy challenges. And we're fortunate to have a team at Medicaid, and I think this is true in the broader Department of Social Services as well, where our team members like trying to solve those problems. We don't run away from them. We like to try to solve them and make them better. And so when I took this job in 2018, I've joked with my team about this, I thought I might be here, you know, a couple of years. And the average tenure of a Medicaid director in the country is pretty short. But I've been here 7 years now because I think the work that we're doing matters. It matters to our participants, it matters to our providers, and it impacts the other areas of the state's budget as well. So when we talk about sustainability in Medicaid and providing for the needs of Missouri's most vulnerable, which is our two core tenets, those are things that are, you know, pretty easy to stay interested and really find some passion in trying to fix.
Whenever I hear Republicans talk about Medicaid in shorthand, they often talk about it as a financial burden as opposed to a way to really help the less fortunate. I'm not accusing you of ever putting it that way, though you have talked about the financial costs when you were in elected office.
Sure.
Has your view of this program changed from when you were an elected official to an administrator of this program based off seeing it firsthand?
You certainly get to see the impact in a more direct way. And so the benefit of that perspective has certainly changed. I think I certainly have a much more detailed understanding of how the program operates and the ability to think through what fiscal sustainability for the program means in a different way than I would have had when I was in the General Assembly. But I think, you know, our partners in the General Assembly, and I think this is, you know, not obviously not everybody feels the same way, but I think people recognize the value of a Medicaid program. But I don't think that it's necessarily needs to be kind of an either or kind of conversation. You can see the value in the program, want it to do exactly what it was designed to do, to provide for the most vulnerable of our citizens, but also want it to be fiscally sustainable for the long term. Our aspirational goal at Medicaid is that we want to run a best-in-class Medicaid program, which means it's not just a Medicaid program that's as good as Illinois or maybe a little better than Kansas. We really do want to aspire to being a best-in-class Medicaid program. You cannot be a best-in-class Medicaid program if you don't do two things. One, you have to provide for the needs of Missouri's most vulnerable, because that's the reason the program exists. But you also have to do that in a way that's financially sustainable. So we focus on that, you know, at the same time. And I don't think there's any inconsistency in recognizing both of those things can be important.
We've talked about a lot of different things and challenges and potential hurdles in the next 4, 5, 10 years. What's something that we haven't discussed that you see as either a big challenge or a big opportunity for this program?
I think one of the things that we've been most focused on over the last, say, you know, year and a half to 2 years is our maternal and infant health care. Missouri Medicaid covers just over 40% of the deliveries in this state are to Medicaid moms. And it's no secret that Missouri, like a lot of other states, our outcomes are not as good as we would like them to be. And so we have been focused on a whole suite of initiatives that we think will improve those outcomes over time. So really exciting, not one thing, but rather a combination of things to improve those outcomes. So that's one thing, Jason. The other thing is, you know, we're really, really proud of the amount of transformation work that's happened in the program related to how we pay providers. When I started, Missouri Medicaid had some of the most outdated payment methodologies in the country. So forget for a second how much we pay, just how we pay.
You probably send like literal paper checks to people.
We still do some of those. But we have had payment methodologies that were grounded in 1995 cost reports. I focus on that because that's the year I graduated from high school. Probably need some updating. We have been able, you know, in partnership with the General Assembly and their help through the budget work, we've been able to modernize really every single area of our every single lane of payment methodology that we have, from hospital care to how we pay physicians, how we pay for nursing facility care, and big changes in pharmacy. So those are big systemic things with how our Medicaid program operates now that improve the sort of the fairness of how we pay, but also help with the sustainability financially of the program for the long term. So those would be a couple of things I'd point out.
That was Todd Richardson, the director of Missouri's Medicaid program. You can find all of our coverage of Missouri politics by going to stlpr.org. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, and thank you for listening. That was Todd Richardson, who is in charge of Missouri's Medicaid program. If you want to read more about the Show Me State's politics and government, go to stlpr.org. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, and thank you for listening. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio.
This is Politically Speaking.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.